Hey everyone, and welcome to Seriously Risky Business, the podcast we do here at Risky Biz HQ, which is mostly targeted towards the policy and government audience. We would like to thank, of course, the Hewlett Foundation's Cyber Initiative for supporting this work, and also our founding corporate sponsor for all of this Seriously Risky Biz stuff, Proofpoint. And of course, my name is Patrick Gray, and I am joined by Tom Uren now to talk through Tom's work that he's done this week in our Seriously Risky Business newsletter. And Tom, the major feature that you wrote up today was your analysis of Citizen Lab and Reuters' deep dive into a covert communication system that the CIA stood up for its agents in the field, agents and assets in Iran and China. We know it was used there. This system was stood up, we think, around 2004. But it was, it all came crashing down in 2009 when the adversaries were able to actually figure this system out, figure out who it was communicating with, and actually execute a bunch of these agents. And, at the time this story first broke, which was around 2018, Adam Boileau and myself, we expected that the mistakes that CIA had made with this were going to be fairly embarrassing. But we've got a lot more detail now, and it looks absolutely staggeringly incompetent.
Yeah, it's hard to talk about it without seeming hyperbolic. Yeah. I think I described it as horrendously bad. And I was reading the description, and my first thought was like, no, this can't be right. This is so bad. And what I zeroed in on at first is that the way they set the system up is you have a pretend website that only one spy uses. And that kind of makes sense when you're not thinking about it from the perspective of someone who can see all of the internet all at once. Like, it makes sense from a human point of view. There's this special thing just for me. No one else will discover it because it's, no one else knows about it. But when you're a counterintelligence agency and you can do things like have a look at DNS logs, it immediately gives you a way to find out those websites by saying which websites are really rarely visited and who is visiting those websites. And so it allows you to narrow down the scope of who you're looking for straight away. And even if every website was totally different, you could still come up with a list. So it just seemed to me straight off to be a terrible idea to have such a simple way to get to a shortlist.
Yeah, we should say too that these websites, essentially, they were, they had a chat ability, right? So that these agents could go chat to their handlers and whatever. And it's all still there in the Internet Archive. You can go to the Wayback Machine and find this stuff, and that's what Citizen Lab's done. And they did, they used advanced techniques such as right-clicking and viewing source to find the messaging components of this website. And where this gets critical, absolutely critical, is once you've found one of these websites, there are all sorts of objects in there that you can essentially Google Doc to find other domain names, other infrastructure that is being used for the same purpose. And, if I had to guess how this happened, perhaps counterintelligence officers in some of these countries arrested one person, discovered that this was the method through which they were communicating with CIA, did a bit of reverse engineering on how it worked, and then just Google Doc'd and found the rest of them. And as I say, this led to a whole bunch of people being killed. You just wonder, and I said this in yesterday's show, right? Which is, you wonder who signed off on this. And really what your piece has sort of tried to figure out is, like, how on earth would something like this have happened? How could it happen?
Yeah, so in the title I referenced Dunning-Kruger, which is the psychological sort of model where you start off with having no idea that you're doing something terrible. And I think the CIA was in that space. It's also
Dunning-Kruger is basically you're too stupid to know that you're stupid.
Yeah, exactly. Like, you're unconsciously incompetent. You don't even know how bad it is. And that's why I started talking about, like, what struck me. Like, the entire premise of the system was wrong. So they've started in the wrong place, and then they've made all these sorts of other mistakes that you spoke about on top of that. So it's a house of cards that doesn't even have a stable base. And that tells me that they never really spoke to anyone who had any idea of how you would try, from an internet point of view, not from a human point of view, but from an internet point of view, how you would unravel that kind of, I guess it is a system, right? Ideally, you'd want it to be unique per spy, but they didn't do that. Like, they did the sort of facade unique per spy, but the actual
They used a unique domain. But quite often these websites were using sequential IP addresses because they bought them in bulk. Like the whole thing is just so utterly, utterly incompetent and insane. And the thing that is just even more infuriating about this, Tom, is that the United States has a very, very capable cyber agency in the NSA. And you would think surely if CIA went to NSA and said, look, we're trying to design a covert communication system that's resistant to being discovered. What do you think of this? You know, even in 2004, which is when we think this system was first stood up, NSA would have told them that they were insane.
Yeah, I think so. I think the one of the early stories about this covert communication system talks about it possibly being used somewhere, a very low threat environment. And if I recall correctly, they said something about a war zone. And that doesn't really make sense in the sense that in a war zone, probably the internet is not the best way to communicate, certainly back in 2004. So there's this kind of paradox where the places where you could use it would be the places where the internet at that time didn't really exist as a reliable communications mechanism. And I just think that I think it's a failure of understanding how the world is changing in the main. So the world's changed around the CIA. They're a secret squirrel organization. They don't realize that it has really serious implications for not only the way they communicate, but the way that agents can be uncovered. And presumably it took this crisis to make them wake up. The operatives were being discovered by counterintelligence agencies for 4 years, 2009 to 2013. So it wasn't even that they got the hint and woke up immediately. It took several years for that to sort of percolate through the hive mind, is my interpretation of what's come out subsequently. What I didn't go into in this story, there was actually a whistleblower who claimed that the covert system, well, it's the reason I didn't go into it is it's not 100% certain that he's talking about the same thing. But it really, really looks like from the redacted court filings that he was talking about this system being broken and the CIA losing agents because of it. And he was basically ignored and pushed out of the agency.
So there was actually a whistleblower complaint that might have been about this, was there?
Yeah. So that appears to be the case. And so it's really both ignoring reality and then denying it. And the initial reports in, say, the New York Times talk about, we believe it was a mole. And then the journalists talk to many other people who go, nah, the mole didn't know enough to undo all these agents. And so there's a kind of willing blindness even. To me, it's just bureaucracies have this kind of inertia and they kind of move forward. And my guess is that's not, they didn't just never recognized it as a problem. They moved forward. They kept on moving forward. You know, that was approved way back when. It worked for many years. Why would it change now? But of course, technology changes.
If it ain't broke, don't fix it. You know, our agents keep getting hung, but, you know, we can't necessarily say that it's because this system is terrible.
Yeah. And like I said, I didn't talk about the whistleblower in the article because it's not 100% clear that it is the same system. You know, you redact a whole lot of stuff and you can read different things into it. But I think it's concerning.
Yeah, I mean, I have no doubt that that's possible, right? That someone inside would see this and just say, "Hey, what are you doing? This is crazy." But you did allude to this earlier about the way that the world has changed around the CIA, and you know, the world is much more digital now. And even maintaining a decent cover for, say, an officer going entering a certain country these days is quite difficult in light of things like the OPM breach. I guess it's interesting to bring that into this discussion because you would really hope that CIA has adapted to this new reality when the signs are not very good when we look at what happened in the case of their covert communication systems. Now, admittedly, this is, you know, going back nearly a decade since they stopped using it. But, it's impossible to read about it without thinking, geez, you know, what on earth is going on with the organizational culture over there when something this incompetent actually happened and stayed in place for years?
Yeah, so I think another phenomena in organizations is that the senior management grew up in a different time. Like they just tend to be older because that's, you know, the way the world works. And they get very good at doing things that were relevant 20 years ago. And I think that's another... And the world has been changing faster than
the management,
know, the
sort of yeah,
the,
yeah,
the
yeah.
relevance of that expertise. So I think there's a dynamic there that applies to all organizations, not just the CIA. And I think one of my favorite things to talk about is how, my favorite rants, I suppose, is how too much secrecy is actually counterproductive. So I think there's several things that occur in all agencies, like you know, outside the intelligence community, all bureaucracies, that actually kind of get worse in that space. You know, that culture of secrecy, you don't want to talk about it. And like there are good reasons, but you need to know.
Well, I mean, this is a really interesting thing that you mentioned in your analysis of this, which is one of the reasons CIA probably didn't go to anyone outside for help with this is because they were trying to keep it really secret, right? And not, tell more people who could then leak this information. So they may have been thinking they were doing the right thing by not getting expert eyes on it.
I am pretty convinced. I think that's highly likely.
Yeah.
Like sort of in my time in ASD, I dealt with various HUMIT people, and they're always like super protective of sources. Like they don't want to say anything at all. And I think this could well have been the root of this problem.
It's crazy, right? Where they're trying to do the right thing, but wind up not knowing what they don't know.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, it's an interesting thing. This seems to me, and look, I've obviously never worked at an intelligence agency like you have. It seems to me that there's a bit of a animosity between SIGINT and HUMINT people. Is that right? Like it's almost like cops and firefighters, you know what I mean? Like do you have like a HUMINT versus SIGINT like football match every year or something where you can get on the field and just like kick the crap out of each other?
I would describe it as collegiate, but there was definitely differences, right? So
yeah.
The HUMINT people are very good at talking to people. And it was always sort of bemusing to me whether it was part of the training or whether it was the selection process. And from my point of view, SIGINT was always a sort of purer int in terms of there's less ethical conundrums. Like if you listen to someone by interception, there's, you know, it's kind of like if a tree falls in the forest and no one hears except for the person at the end of the listening line.
Except for ASD.
Yeah,
exactly.
Whereas with HUMINT, you're actually taking people, often becoming friends with them and then convincing them to betray their country. So I think the moral stakes are much higher, and I think it's a much messier business.
So the SIGINT people think they have the moral high ground, and the HUMINT people think SIGINT's not real spying, spying's doing the betrayal stuff, right? Something along those lines. Am I close?
I had very few conversations about ethics and morality when I was some people would talk about it. I think mostly everyone thought they were doing the right thing, and I think in the whole intelligence profession, that's, you know, there's a mission that people believe in and they do it. I wouldn't disagree with your characterization.
So look, just to wrap up this part of the conversation, you know, if anyone's listening who is a political staffer or working for, you know, some politician who's in a position to actually exert some sort of oversight over agencies like CIA, HUMINT agencies in whatever country, like, what should they do to stop this sort of thing from happening? I mean, should there be some sort of mandated checking of work when it comes to, HUMINT agencies trying to do cyber stuff? Because that seems like it seems pretty crazy that there was no just default process to tap the expertise of the cyber agency when doing the cyber thing.
What I would do is I'd make a case study out of this and make it an example of organizational failure and how things went wrong, and really try and dive into why they went wrong. I think mandating checks and stuff like that, I'm not a fan of. I think people are trying to make the right decision. And if they knew that that was the right decision at the time, they would have done it. Like I don't have any doubt of that. I think it's some other articles have taken the angle that something went wrong or that there's some individual that's accountable. Whereas I think this is very much a cultural thing, and the way to change that is to educate about what the problem was.
Yeah, yeah, I wholeheartedly agree. So look, let's talk about our next topic this week, which is, a fun one, actually, which is, it turns out, and this is an item that first surfaced in April and we all missed it. And our colleague, Catalin Kimpanu, stumbled across it again the other day and sent it to us and said, hey, Tom, you know, you'll probably find this one interesting. But there is actually a smartphone hacking scene in North Korea. Tell us about that, Tom.
Yeah, so the broader report is by this nonprofit called Lumen, and it's the nonprofit's about providing North Koreans with uncensored communications. So it looks at how there's a Wi-Fi network in Pyongyang. It's an intranet. It's not connected to the internet. And there was also North Korean specially modified smartphones with all sorts of protections. And the first thing that grabbed my eye is that they have a Big Brother type monitoring system where on every phone they have something called Trace Viewer, and it just takes screenshots randomly and regularly, I guess. And the owner of the phone can see that the screenshots are being taken. So it's this reminder, you know, we know what you're doing. It fills up this directory and you can't delete them off the phone.
Yeah.
And so that's some dystopian...
Well, it's sort of what you'd expect from a North Korean government-supplied smartphone, right?
Yeah, exactly. It's what you'd expect, but it's also, to me, it's impactful to know that it actually exists and has been implemented. Like there's
They're showing the users that it's there for a reason, which is for the effect, which is you are being watched. But, you know, this, of course, is why people have started sort of like, you know, jailbreaking the phones.
Yeah, so there's a number of different reasons. So I talk about how they, and it's sort of based around universities, which makes sense. And so North Korea has a program to educate people as software developers. They go overseas and earn contract software development money for the state. And some of those people also become hackers and hack to get money for the state and for other strategic goals. So those people get the skills that allow them to know how to root phones. But there's all sorts of reasons that individuals want to root phones. So one of them is simply that because of the Trace Viewer app, people can tell how old a phone is. So the more photos in that folder, the older the phone is and the less it's worth. So if you can root a phone, delete those files out of that folder, it makes the phone look younger and therefore you can sell it for more money.
That's wild. I mean, do these things, like at the point where the storage fills up, do you just have to bin the phone or do you send it back to the government for a reset or how does that even work?
It didn't go into that. You would expect that it like ages off, but of course that's not going to be the North Korean way of doing things. But they also, like some of the applications were also trivial, like just having a new startup screen or a wallpaper or something like that. But then there's things like being able to put on different types of games or photo filters or different types of media.
So for the North Koreans who want to take the cat ear, Snapchat filter selfie, basically.
Yep, that's right.
Yeah, what a time. What a time to be alive. So that's an interesting one in the newsletter there. And we've also got some comments from the head of the NCSC to talk about. Tom, Lindy Cameron has basically made some comments on what she has called, you know, Russia's sort of sustained cyber war campaign against Ukraine, but sort of pointed out like stuff like... kind of agrees with us, which is that it's been a bit of a fizzer and that Russia's cyber war is basically going about the same way as its ground war.
Yeah. So what I liked about this is that it both covers that cyber operations are a normal part of warfare now. So she makes the point that both sides are using cyber capabilities and both sides understand the potential. And she talks like the potential of integrating cyber and information confrontation. So it's all about putting cyber operations in the mix to get some bigger effect. What annoys me about the mainstream narrative is that it seems to be either very polarized, I guess. Either cyber is, you know, Armageddon or it's useless. Whereas I think it's got a space that's mostly in the middle. Sometimes it'll be more useless than others and sometimes it'll have more impact than others. She does end up with the kind of optimistic note that defenders actually have a lot of ability to make a difference. So
Well, I mean, the Ukrainians, you know, the Ukrainians have actually done quite well on defense, which is, I don't think people were necessarily expecting that, but I guess they were expecting it since they had their power infrastructure fiddled with by Russia, you know, so many years ago, that this is an area where they've actually tooled up and it looks like they've been able to, you know, at least not suffer terribly under Russian cyber attacks.
Yeah, it hasn't been, the attacks haven't had catastrophic impacts, I guess is the way you'd say it. So she talks about, Cameron talks about the Ukrainians having been made match fit by Russia going at them for 10 years. And so they've really had a lot of practice in being attacked and recovering. And so if you're well practiced, you're actually in a much better place than if you're just responding for the first time. To me, it's interesting that you would consider Ukraine, I think most people would consider Ukraine's cyber defense as a success. Yeah. And they haven't done things like, you know, software bill of materials or asset inventories.
Yeah. they've done rapid response and YubiKeys everywhere, right? And they've actually gone all right.
Yeah. Yep.
I mean, I think the wild card in all of this, right, because we are sort of heading towards a consensus about, you know, what cyber has looked like through the Russia-Ukraine war when we've had Viasat and then a lot of lower-level stuff. And, you know, there seems to be a consensus forming. And consensus is dangerous because that's when stuff usually flips around, right? And my concern is that with Russia being sort of painted into a corner more recently, you know, with its campaign going pretty badly and domestic pressure building on Putin at home and, you know, the annexations and everything and sanctions starting to bite and all sorts of this stuff, I do wonder if we are going to see Russia start to go a bit feral, you know, perhaps next year. So I think that's the one wild card here, which could make us reevaluate this quite sensible consensus around what cyber is and isn't.
Yeah. So also this week, and again, I didn't write about it, the Finnish intelligence service spoke about how Russia may react, and they pointed out that Russia's lost a lot of human assets overseas because people have been kicked out of embassies. So there's possibly a pivot towards cyber operations there. And they also point out that sanctions could be encouraging a push towards more commercial type or intellectual property.
Yeah, so estimate. financially motivated crime is one thing. I mean, what the Finnish are talking about there is collection, but what I'm talking about is destructive stuff. I think that is something that we could see.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know that we will, because it does carry escalation risks for Russia, but I just think it's something that could happen.
Yeah, and if you look at if you sort of use a balloon analogy, if they're being squeezed on the actual war front, where's the soft underbelly? It's probably not in Ukraine anymore. So perhaps it's elsewhere. So that definitely seems like a possibility.
Yeah, well, better packets than nukes. I'd rather see the cyber attacks than the tactical nukes. Personally, that would be fine by me. Now, the last thing that we're going to talk about is this Canadian fella who was arrested for, I think he hacked something like 17 organizations in the United States and a bunch in Canada. He was a Netwalker ransomware affiliate who seemed to have some pretty reasonable links with the actual, you know, Netwalker gang proper. This bloke was arrested and then extradited to the United States. He has been sentenced to 20 years in prison, which is... Now, normally on this show, like, you know, we live in a country which has sentencing guidelines that are much lighter than they are in the United States. And normally I sort of decry that, you know, quite often people are sentenced to long sentences for stuff that would, you know, wouldn't even carry a jail term here in Australia. But in this case, I see that a ransomware operator got a 20-year sentence and I just think, good.
Yeah, he was quite prolific. I mean, I was kind of stunned at how much money he'd made in a very short time. So around about a year. And I think the figure I saw
was... $18 million or something?
Well, he gave up $21.5 million. I seem to remember $68 million somewhere, but so he actually...
Who can tell with the way crypto prices fluctuate, right?
That's right. It's probably $2.50 now. But also the kind of range of organizations he targeted were pretty, you know, hospitals... I think there was schools as well. Is that right? They were not.
I think it was like, it's a little bit hard to tell because they talk about how he hit all of these different organizations, and then the press releases from DOJ say networker targeted organizations, right, like hospitals and whatever. So it's not clear, but like, I mean, this guy was prolific and, you know, hitting all sorts of targets. I have no doubt there were some hospitals involved and whatnot, but you know, a 20-year sentence rises to the level of actually being a meaningful deterrent. And that's why I kind of think it's worth, like, as far as I'm concerned, if you're ransomwaring a hospital or something like that and you get locked up for 20 years, you absolutely deserve it.
Yeah, I think that's right. Like, hospitals, they're targets where there are real consequences for ransomware.
Yeah, absolutely. So, sucks to be him, as we say here at Risky Biz. But Tom, that's it for our discussion of the newsletter. Obviously, there are more items in the newsletter. And if people want to subscribe to Tom's newsletter, just head over to risky.biz/subscribe and hit up the Substack link that is there. But yeah, Tom, great to chat to you as always, mate. And I'll look forward to doing it again next week.
Thanks, Pat.